Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is Harry Wayne Casey. Yes, Casey of Casey and the Sunshine Band. Casey, great to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Bob.
So how you been coping with the coronavirus and staying home, et cetera?
I don't know. It's been very interesting. I have been through a lot of different types of emotions. I've never been this idle in my whole 70 years.
So have you gone through it alone, or do you have a significant other, or what's it been like?
No, my nights are alone, but I have staff here at the house, so I'm around people during the day, but I have family members and friends that stop in and stuff, but yeah, so it's been very interesting. I mean, I've been going out pretty much. I mean, whatever they would allow here in Miami, which has been pretty open.
Okay, and have you been vaccinated?
I was vaccinated. I had COVID, then I had the Regeneron IV infusion done, and then had my second vaccination.
Do you have any idea how you got COVID?
I'm not really sure, because the only thing I could think of, maybe, because I was out with a friend of mine. Her and I went, we were together on a Thursday night, then on a Friday night we went out with two other friends. And then 7 days later, 5 days later, I detected positive, told her, and then she got a test and she detected positive. And but our friends didn't. They didn't. They were negative. So the only thing I can maybe think of is where I was might have been a little bit lackadaisical and not, paying attention is valet parking. And on that Friday night, someone valet parked my car. So I don't know if they could have gotten the car, coughed in it or whatever, and the germs are, I don't know how long the germs float around, or if they were on the air conditioning vent. I don't know. I'm not sure. That's the only way I could have gotten it at that point, really.
And how long ago did you get it?
Actually, I got it 2 days before my 70th birthday in January.
Okay, so psychologically, what was it like hitting 70?
I don't like the number, but hitting all these numbers doesn't really feel too much different than I don't feel any different inside than the year before, or whatever, or 2 years before, 10 years before, really. It's not, it's a seven. It's I'm sure there must be, some kind of psychological stuff going on in my head, but I haven't, I don't know if I've recognized that yet.
Well, I know that 60 really fucked me up. And
right.
Then in terms of numbers, I always felt young until I hit 67. I said, I don't care how I feel, that number is old. And it's kind of scary.
It is scary. I mean, I do think of it now like, wow, I'm seven, zero. It's like, it is kind of crazy. Because it is an old number. It's not like, I'm not like 12, I'm not 21, I'm not 30, I'm not 40,
Well, I turned 68 a month or so ago. And one thing, especially in light of COVID, is, shit, if there's something I want to do, I better do it. Because it's not like I have endless runway here.
Right.
So, during the break, did you play music at home? Did you write music at home or anything?
I've been working on a project now for the last 8 years, I think going on nine now, because I started in 2012. And during that time, I was working on a musical and the book for, a possible movie and that, So that's kind of what I was working on a little bit during that time. We released a single, Put a Little Love in Your Heart. So I was just working on different things. I have a new single coming out July 23rd called Romantic. It's from my album. I'm getting ready to release 53 brand new songs.
How do you plan to release them?
1 month at a time for 7 months.
And are they already, well, 53, you mean, if there's 53, 7 months, we won't get through all 53 if it's 1 month at a time.
No. We're dividing the 7 months into the 53 songs.
Oh, I get it now.
So there'll be like seven individual EPs coming out.
And are you putting them out yourself, or is there a label involved?
No, there is right now. I mean, I have a deal with a label that's distributed through Sony. And then in Europe, we have a German label called ZYX Records. I'm not sure if they're the ones getting it or whatever, but we're still shopping it.
And all
right now, that's what I have, you know, what we have now, but I don't know if that they're going to really end up getting it or not.
So all 53 songs are done.
Yes.
And why 53 and why 7? Is it just numbers, or do they thematically sit together?
Because I couldn't stop. And this guy that I write with over in the UK sometimes was messing around. And, you know, he always goes online showing how he creates a song or whatever. And he came up with this quirky little song 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I love it. I said, send me the track or whatever. And I went in and put a vocal on it. It's really a fun song. So that put it at 53.
And, you know, the music business certainly changed since the last century. So it's very hard to get attention. So to what degree, what plans do you have to gain attention? And in terms of expectations, what expectations have you got?
I don't know. I've been in discussion with my managers and stuff, and they're introducing me to me. I guess there's a lot of what they call influencers out there right now. And you connect with these influencers, and they help kind of spread the word. Aside from some of the traditional ways or whatever, and doing dance versions of the songs and maybe having it, you know, come from the club, you know, backwards through the clubs or whatever. I don't know. You know, it's just, it's a whole new world. I mean, when we used to really release a record, we would put it in a few markets. We'd press up a few hundred or whatever and make sure there were some records in record stores in those markets. And, you know, if you started seeing something happen, then you knew to press more records and to put it in more markets. there's no consistency to anything. I don't know how anybody's doing it anymore. Other than, you know, and radio has gotten so, like, one company owns everybody. So if the one guy doesn't like it, nobody plays it, you know, or whatever. Or, you know, I guess the amount of money you have to spend to get it on radio is you know, just astronomically high, you know, to hire a PR person. So it's very interesting. I mean, it's just, you know, a lot different than when I was growing up, that's for sure. And I'm sure we, you know, we'll figure it out. I mean, first of all, you know, a hit record always reveals itself. So, I mean, we're just going to go through the regular channels of marketing and promotion and some newer channels. Like I said, you know, with influencers and other things that my managers have been talking to me about. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
So at this date, with the business having changed and you having gigantic success in your history, what keeps you motivated to create new music and stay in the business?
It wasn't like, you know, what's really interesting is I wasn't until all of a sudden in 2012, it's like I woke up out of some kind of creative coma and I kind of felt like I was 23 again with the creative process, the things that were going through my head. And that's what led to these 52 songs. I just couldn't stop. And I don't even know how to explain it. But it's almost like some other force or whatever is driving it. I know up until that point, I was a little bit sort of afraid of, you know, maybe being successful, you know, that way again, or having, you know, some kind of success with recordings or whatever. And I used to fight it all the time. And then I woke up one morning and said, I'm not going to fight this. I'm just going to let, you know, let the forest take it or let whatever it is take it. And in 2012, that light came on and those doors opened. And here I am, 2021, with 53 songs that I really think is some of the best stuff I've ever done in my career. And I'm very happy with them all, very proud of it all. And, we'll see where it goes.
So let me just understand this awakening in 2012. Prior to that, were you afraid of not reaching the heights artistically and commercially of what you'd once reached?
Or no, I was more afraid of success than reaching. I'm never afraid to reach. I mean, I've been in this business so long, and you're always as hot as your last record or whatever. And you put stuff out there. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, you move on and you do something else. For that, and I still have 9 number one records that I have or whatever, and I tour, do 70, 80 shows a year. So, I'm fine with anything. I whichever way the wind's going to blow, it's going to blow. My destiny's already been set.
Well, when you say fear of success, can you tell us a little bit more of that?
Especially in this world today with the press and media the way they are. I don't know. I just, for me, I had these dreams of what I thought success was. And it definitely was nothing what I thought. It was very political. It was very lonely. It was very demanding, sometimes demeaning. Sometimes it was, there were just a lot of different emotions that came from it all. And some of it was enjoyable and some of it wasn't. And so I was more of afraid of what wasn't enjoyable than the other part that was enjoyable. And whether I wanted to put myself back into that situation again. And again, I just one day just woke up and said, I'm just going to let everything happen and go and see what happens. That's where I'm at right now.
Tell me more about the loneliness of success.
I don't know. It was just, I'm a very person. Did I say that right?
A people we get the person. Message.
I'm a very people person.
Right.
So for the most part, I do like to be around everyone, know everyone's having a good time, and then kind of just go step aside for a minute. I like my alone time too, but I'm a very people person. I love to be around people. And so in the height of my career or whatever, here I was, couldn't go anywhere, couldn't do anything because I would just be mugged or, in my hotels would be 5,000-6,000 people outside the hotel. We'd have guards on the elevators and on the exits and every entrance. And, it was like I was always on the outside, inside looking out. And, from my hotel room, looking down at all these people and wow, I just really like to be in the middle of that or be down there with everybody, knowing that that really wasn't a possibility. And for many reasons. And just the whole thing, of success, you're very isolated. I mean, you have all these people around you, but, you're doing all these other things that you kind of have to do. Not all of them that you want to do, but you have to kind of do them because it's all part of the process. And so everybody else is having a good time and going out and doing all this and, I'm sitting in the room by myself or I'm sitting there having to do 50 interviews or whatever it is, it's not like it's an 8-hour job. It's like a 24-hour job. And then, on top of it, having to, not only having to come up with the next project for Casey and the Sunshine Band, but other artists that I was producing and writing for at the time was with George McRae or Jimmy Bullhorn or different, other artists and stuff. So I had a lot of obligations to do stuff, which kept me kind of, in this space, 24 hours, 7 days, every day. I mean, I didn't really go on vacations. I didn't do anything. I just, just worked on music.
So what did you think success would look like, and what did it actually look like? Other than
well, the I think when everybody, you know, we always have this running joke, when does the glamour begin? I think, you know, I think everybody thinks it's glamorous. I think, I mean, there's a glamorous part to it and everything, but, you know, it's not everything, you know, you only see the book cover, and the book covers always look great till you read the book or you're inside the pages yourself, you know, then it's a whole different story. So, I don't know what I expect. I mean, it's not like I was ignorant to what to expect, because number one, I was in a record company for 5 years before my success with other artists who were successful. I was managing a couple of the artists and doing their bookings, and I was doing a lot of different things. I wanted to know the business. You know, my family's been in the entertainment business, more on the gospel end of it or whatever, and stuff. So I've always kind of been around that level of success, whatever it is, and, you know, knowing the ups and downs of it and that sort of thing. So, but I don't think I ever paid much attention to it, because I was just, I was around and a part of it, and I was happy being in the backdrop. You know, I wasn't the one, you know what I mean? So, you know, after I was done with them, I could go hang out with my friends and do stuff and, you know, and be anywhere I wanted to be without, you know, someone go, there goes KC, and then, you know, a mob scene happened, you know. So, you know, just those parts of it. I mean, I don't know where else to go with this, but.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the perks. A lot of people, they want to be successful for the sex, the money, the access. A, did you have that? B, did you partake of it? C, was it fulfilling?
Wow, you, Bob, you really dig deep, don't you?
Otherwise, we're just going to repeat what you said like for 40 years.
But I, you know what? Because it's very simplistic. I'm not a kind of person. I didn't really do this for money, number one. I did it because it's something I like. It's something I felt like I was born to do. And always had this inner feeling that this is what I was going to do. You know, I definitely didn't do it for sex. You know, sex comes no matter what profession you're in, really. I guess maybe more if you're an entertainer or whatever. But my look at the whole thing was always on a professional level. I did a lot of things because I knew I had to do a show the next day. I didn't do a lot of things. I mean, I didn't do a lot of things because I knew I had to do a show the next day, and I had a obligation to the people that had worked hard for their money or whatever to come and see us. And, you know, they expected a certain, you know, person on that stage. And I had, you know, a lot of things I just had to put aside. You know, this was a obligation. It wasn't like a job. You know, I felt obligated to be what everyone expected when they came to see a show.
But talking about the exterior, other than actually performing, the nature of being famous and famous for your own work, a lot of doors are open and a lot of situations you get put in where you might pinch yourself and say, I can't believe I'm here. Whether right. It's meeting famous people or going, was that part of success?
Those were great perks. You know, getting to meet people. I mean, Dinah Ross was a very big influence. I mean, the whole Motown thing. So getting to meet all those Motown people and stuff like that, and you know, just everybody from you know, entertainers to musicians to actors and actresses that I'd grown up, you know, watching on TV all my life, and getting to actually shake hands with them, talk with them, and chat with them, and some of them even have relationships with some of them. That was all like, that was surreal. That was just, those were definitely pinch me moments. I lost the rest, you know, the other part of the question.
I think you answered it. That's pretty good. Let's go back to managers. You talk about your managers telling you, what has been your experience with managers through your career? A lot of acts, you know, are not positive with their management history.
Well, I managed myself up until 1978. And then I signed with a management company in LA, Catskill and Amore, who were the number one artist representatives in the country. They had Dolly Parton, they had Cher, they had Ava Gabor, Zsa Zsa Gabor, Kate Smith, Mac Davis, America, Olivia Newton-John, Lily Tomlin. I mean, they were a major artist representatives. And so I'm not sure how all that really went, because it was the first time kind of letting go and everything. And there were some things I probably wasn't happy with, but, you know, a lot of things that I was, because it released me from having to deal with it, you know, the way I was up until that point. It just left more room for creative processes and just gave me a little bit more of life back, you know, other than just being 24/7 booking myself, you know, just doing everything myself pretty much.
Well, you had an agent, right?
Yeah, I had a great agent, Gary. His name was Gary Weinberg. He was at ICM. He was the most amazing agent I've ever had in my career.
What made him so great?
You know, we just had a great relationship, and he always made sure that, you know, I knew about everything going on or whatever. And if I liked an idea, or whatever, he made sure I was on it or was doing it. He was more of a manager than my managers, really. You know, it's when you have a really great agent that's on top of everything all the time, you know, not very much can go wrong.
Okay, now you were having success when you were still self-managed. I'm sure, you know, managers came to you. In addition, most acts did have a manager. Did you consciously say, hey, I want to maintain control?
You know, that didn't happen too much that I recall, because number one, I didn't allow myself to be in those situations. And I think part of that was because I was in Miami, and other than going out to do some TV shows or whatever, and not doing those people could get to me or got to me, you know, because of my own staff or the way I moved in and out of a place or, you know, a situation, a TV show or whatever I was doing. I don't think I was that accessible. Again, being in Miami and not in LA or New York, where I could probably be, you know, more in situations, going to more parties and stuff where these, you know, different people could show up and approach me. I was never in that type of situation, I think. I can't remember how the Catskillen thing happened. It might have been when I changed to from ICM to William Morris, maybe, and they said, you know, we have a management company that would be interested in you. I can't remember what happened.
Do you remember why you switched from ICM to William Morris?
ICM was going through some changes at that time. I mean, Gary passed away. I think one of the agents, Jim Ramos, who was one of my agents there also. God, you know, trying to remember all this stuff because it's been so long.
But your main guy died is really the key.
Well, there was just a big shakeup in ICM or whatever. And I, you know, sometimes it's time to change and try new things.
Let's talk about Florida. Florida was kind of sleepy in your heyday. Ultimately, there were recordings at Criteria. Miami became a thing somewhat in the mid-70s. But even though people from the Northeast were moving to Florida and vacationing in Florida forever, suddenly, starting in the 80s and 90s, Miami becomes hip. Everybody moves to Florida. Many people say Florida is the new California, well, at least in terms of crazy stuff going on. And now California has switched from left to right. You have this Governor DeSantis who's having all these laws in the name of freedom. What's your viewpoint on what's going on there in Florida since you live
there?
I'm
not getting into anything political.
Well, let me ask you, what is your viewpoint of what's going on? I mean, just state, since you're on the ground.
Nothing political.
Okay. We're not going to mention any political, and I'm not going to push you, whatever. I'm not going to.
Yeah.
But just tell me.
I don't talk about that stuff.
Okay. I'm just interested. Yeah. Why do you not choose not to talk about that stuff?
I don't think it's a thing people should be talking about. I don't know.
I mean, just because I talk to a lot of people, are you fearful that a potential fan might not agree with you?
No, I'm not. I'm not fearful. I just don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
I don't talk about it.
You talk about it with your friends?
Not really.
Do you keep up on the news?
I do.
Do? Are you optimistic for? Do you have any children?
No, I don't. But I have some wonderful nephews and nieces and great nephews and nieces.
So are you optimistic for the future, or, you know, because you and me only have a limited number of amount of time left?
I don't know. I've been here 70 years, and I don't think anybody's ever done anything correct. So, I'm down the middle.
Okay. So let's go back to this creative jag that you've been on with the 53 songs. What inspires you to write a song?
I started writing mostly, you know, as a young man, because back then you really couldn't talk to your parents about things the way kids can talk to their parents now and stuff. And everything was always supposed to be hush hush. And so I would always write my feelings, whether it was something going on in the world, you know, or how I was feeling, or how I, you know, was feeling rejected by a person, or, you know, that I had feelings for, or situations that I'd been in, you know, with another person. So a lot of it comes from just personal experience, a personal observation, and wishful thinking.
Okay. Now, in this jag in the last 10 years, do you say, okay, it's noon, I have to go to the studio, or are you brushing your teeth or showering and you have a great idea and you got to run to the keyboard?
No, I have an iPhone now, so I just push record. I write it down in my notes on my iPhone, and then if it's an idea of a melody or something, I will go to my iPhone and record it on the record thing on the iPhone.
Let me just put it a different way. Some of the greatest records of all time were, let's talk about Satisfaction by the Stones. You know, Keith Richards had the idea in the middle of the night, leaned over into Norelco, sang the riff. You have that. Whereas today you might have literally 20 writers on a song where they build the track from, you know, the bottom up.
Right.
So are you more of I have the inspiration and let me expand that, or, okay, let me sharpen my pencils. Let's see what I come up with.
Okay. So my new album or the way I mean, before I would always go into this, I had my own studio. I would go into the studio and pretty much put together the song all right then and there. Some of the ideas and some of the things from this new album were created like I'd be at a sound check or whatever, waiting for the band to get it, whatever, and I'd be messing around the keyboard, come up with a little idea or whatever, and kind of put that down on, you know, run my phone or whatever, and then go to the studio when I was doing these projects and record it with the band. Other situations that presented themselves recently were people that I'm collaborating with send me a fully recorded track, at which point I write the melody and lyrics to that track and maybe add some production to that track. So that's a newer way that I've been doing things involving other people. It's not the way I always did it, or the way I, you know, I can go into a studio and come up with a track like that. I mean, it's just doesn't take, give me a beat and I can give you a song.
Is that because just you've done it so much, you just have that skill?
I just have that natural ability. It might be part of that. I mean, it's just something that's inside of me. It's just this thing that I've never been able to really understand or explain. To me, it's mystical. It's magical. It's there. It's just there.
Okay, you grew up in Hialeah.
Right.
I think Hialeah is where the dog track was or something.
No, Hialeah was where the racetrack was.
Okay, where the racetrack. What was What was Hialeah like?
Well, you have to realize I grew up in Miami, so Miami's very transient in a way. I mean, it's a tourist, you know, I can't think of it. It's the tip of my tongue. You know, we depend on tourism. That's our main. What am I trying to say? Our main.
The economy.
Well, yeah, but you know, some people are known for steel. You know, they manufacture steel. We don't have kind of manufacturing places that I know of or whatever. Our economy, you know, is based on tourism. I guess I could say that. So with that said, like in the neighborhood I grew up in, I don't think there's one person from the same state or city. Most of the time, the northern folks would come down, at the beginning of winter, which would be November, and stay until, you know, springtime, and then go back up north. And you can still tell the difference when it's summer and fall and winter and spring in Miami, in Florida, South Florida, because of the traffic. There's always less traffic during the winter, during the summer.
So you grew up right in Miami.
So I my grandfather had some shops and stuff in Miami. My mother was born in Miami, Florida. I was born in a town called Opa-locka because at the time we were living in Miami, but at the time I was born, Opa-locka was basically a army base or naval base or something, army base, I think. And I'm not sure why I was born in that hospital, but that's where I was born. And then when we were 7 years old, we moved into an area called Palm Springs, which was still Dade County. It was still Miami, but it was surrounded by Hialeah. And they gave us a Hialeah zip code, even though Hialeah police couldn't come in there or whatever. And I had to go to a Hialeah school because that was the closest school. There weren't any schools in this Dade County, this little small little area called Palm Springs that was really Miami-Dade County. It wasn't Hialeah. We paid Dade County taxes, not Hialeah taxes or whatever. It was really two separate places, although we had a Hialeah zip code. So basically I grew up in the middle of Hialeah.
Okay.
On the outskirts of it, the middle of it's,
you know. And where you grew up, how far were you from the beach, and was there a beach culture?
Well, I mean, I'm 15, 20 minutes from the beach, you know, maybe depending on traffic now, but. The beach is due east of me.
So you're still where you grew up?
Yes. I haven't left.
And, you know, is there a reason for that?
Well, other than my family being here and everything, I mean, my parents are buried within 10 minutes from my house, and that's where I'll be buried. You know, I've just had this connection here all my life. I'm still in the same house that I purchased in 1976. And it's not no like big 10,000 square foot mansion. So it's like, I'm content in this area. It's not on the beach. It's inland. It's away from all the craziness and everything. And I can be anywhere I want within 15. I'm kind of central. I'm due south of north of Miami International Airport and kind of southwest of Fort Lauderdale Airport. So I'm kind of in the middle of both of them. I'm 20 minutes from either one of them. So I'm in a very convenient spot for getting around and doing whatever I want to do and being away from, you know, the whole South Beach scene and, you know, whatever other, you know, I mean, downtown's growing now. There's all these, you know, with Wynwood and Brickell and, you know, downtown, the revitalization of downtown Miami. Miami's starting to look like New York. I mean, there's so many skyscrapers going up. It's crazy.
And to what degree do people talk about climate change and the water? I just saw in the paper the other day, they're talking about building a seawall. Is that something people talk about there?
I don't know. It's interesting you brought it up because a friend of mine, were talking about it last night for some reason. I don't know why he brought it up, but it got brought up. And, you know, I don't know where I believe in all of that stuff. I mean, number one, Florida has always been underwater. Where I live and most people live here, sand and things were brought in to build it up 6 feet above the sea level. The Everglades is below sea level. So pretty much, and that's not too far from where I live and too far from what all of Miami was pretty much, you know, the Everglades are underwater at one point. So I guess if it goes back to that, then it's the circle of life, isn't it?
Yeah. Did you used to watch that Everglades show growing up?
Maybe on an occasion.
And you ever go out in the airboat? I used to watch that religiously. Do you ever go out in an airboat? I mean, that was like a big thing on TV in the North.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's that like?
It's fun. It's exhilarating. I mean, you know, you're sailing through these, the grasses. It's exhilarating. It's a lot of fun. They're very fast.
Okay, so what kind of kid are you growing up?
I'm like Spanky and our gang and stuff from the Little Rascals, pretty much. I was doing all of that stuff, building things. We would have shows and parades and, I built race cars and, I'd build rides in my backyard. I mean, I did. You know, I did everything. I loved everything. I mean, would put up a garden. I mean, I grew up in a great neighborhood with a lot of kids, and we had baseball in the middle of the street and football and box ball and every season was, you know, that's what we would do. And, we were just very close, you know, families were close then. And kids weren't in, you know, we were outside except to eat and then go to bed.
Yeah. And how many kids in your family?
I just had one sister, a younger sister.
Okay. And your parents did what for a living?
My mother originally didn't work, and my father owned a furniture store when he first came to Miami. And then he was head of a feed company, security feed company. And then he retired from all that and became a postman, actually. That's what he wanted to do. He wasn't that for long, but he wanted to be that. He just wanted to kind of, he said as being a postman, he didn't have nobody standing over him telling, you know, or anything like that. They wanted him to be a supervisor at one point. He refused it, I don't know how many times.
And were your parents supportive of your dreams? What kind of relationship did you have with them?
My father was my father raised my sister and I to be very independent. He never, I don't ever remember him commenting on anything The only thing he ever was concerned about me was who I was hanging around with and that sort of thing. He never did. My father was just a regular average guy. He didn't want for anything. He didn't. Material things were not important to him at all. I don't think he ever bought, the only radio he ever bought in his entire life was from my mother, or maybe one for me for Christmas, but I don't think he ever owned his own radio in his entire life, or a record player or anything like that. He definitely wasn't musically inclined, although many of his family members were. My mother, on the other hand, she was quite a, she loved to dance. She loved to, you know, her and her sisters actually did radio commercials when they were younger. And my mother, you know, was kind of hanging out with people like Aretha Franklin and the Sam and Dave and Ray Charles and whoever would come into Miami. She'd be at those clubs hanging out with them and stuff. And my mother at one point, you know, told me, why don't I get a job and make something of myself? I think because, you know, she hung around that crowd or whatever, was probably fearful of what I would get into and that sort of thing. So, although they, you know, my parents were divorced, so it wasn't like I was living with my father. So my mother wasn't around enough to, you know, to say anything. I generally really think that, you know, I was allowed to do and be whatever I wanted to be, and it didn't matter. I was going to be what I wanted to be anyway.
What age were you when your parents divorced?
10.
And you ended up living with your father. Your sister lived with the father too?
Correct.
And that's unusual at that time.
My mother didn't show up to court, I understand.
Wow. So you're playing in the street, et cetera. Were you just a member of the group or were you a leader?
Where?
Growing up.
I would say I'm somewhat of a leader. I mean, I'm not much of a follower. I will go along with something. You know, I'm an Aquarius. I'm kind of a chameleon. I kind of fit into any situation. I can make myself fit into any situation. I'm not one that has to be the leader or whatever. I like a little consistency and, you know, direction. But I'm just a, like, go with the flow kind of person, as long as the flow is not dangerous.
Okay, so when do you start playing music?
All my life, pretty much. Because interesting enough, in elementary school or whatever, I was playing, I started playing a clarinet. I mean, I'm not even sure why I picked that instrument. We didn't have a piano in the house that I remember until my sister wanted to take piano lessons. And all of a sudden, we had a piano, even though everyone knew I wanted to play the piano. I mean, I'd go to my aunt's homes and they all had pianos, and they wouldn't even let me near the piano because I guess they said I was banging on it or whatever. And I remember growing up, and my grandmother, I always loved the organ and the keyboard. I had a cousin that was just one of the most amazing piano players you've ever listened to. There was nothing he couldn't play, and all by ear. He was never trained. So I always loved the keyboard. I remember being in my grandmother's backyard and just taking a piece of board or whatever and pretending it was a keyboard and going, dude, you know, making the sounds like it was an organ and moving my fingers across the piece of wood. So I guess I've been playing a long time, even if it was a piece of wood without anything on it. I don't know.
Well, you take clarinet in school. Do you ever take piano lessons?
I did take some piano lessons until the teacher said I knew more than her. And I'm not sure if that was because I play piano and I have some regrets that I don't, you know, I'm not like honest. I mean, it's very interesting because, I mean, I'm a very simplistic player or whatever, but the most educated of Berkeley trained pianists can't even duplicate what I play. So I at a certain part of my life, I certainly wasn't one to sit down and go, dun, 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 dun. I mean, I just didn't have that in me. I just had more energy and wanted, I'd rather be outside with my friends and everything than going, you know, dun, 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 dun. You know, although I did enough to, you know, to learn to, you know, to make my teacher happy. But I was always worried about, when I went to college and I took music classes, I never would have probably been able to be a concert pianist or have a degree in music because I didn't want to, I was worried about if I took these classes, it would change the natural ability that I had, that it would you know, just make me like the rest of, I guess I was a little bit anti-establishment, so it made me like the rest of the machine, and I didn't never want to be part of the machine.
So
if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you read music?
As far, I mean, like if I sat down, yeah, I mean, I could, yeah, I mean, I can read it. I don't know how, I mean, years ago, I probably read and played it faster than I probably could now, but I could definitely sit down and I know what a G is, A, I mean, I know what they are and I could play them on the, I definitely can play them. Yeah.
And did you finish college?
No, because I 2 years into my college, I had the number one record in the world.
Oh, that's certainly definitive. But going back a chapter, in 1964, the Beatles came. Was that a big transitional moment? At what point did you decide you wanted to make music your career?
Well, evidently, my decision was made in elementary school. There's not a time I can't remember that we used to have to fill out these 3x5 cards every year for some reason. You know, you had to fill it out with your name. It had occupation in there, and I always put entertainer. I can't remember ever putting anything else in that spot but entertainer. So I've known all my life, this is what I was going to do, and this is what I was meant to be.
Were you affected by the whole music explosion in the 60s in terms of the Beatles' British Invasion and then, you know, San Francisco and the English blues groups, or was that not your thing?
Okay, well, number one, it wasn't really my thing. I was very, my mother loved R&B music, so I grew up listening to Nancy Wilson, the Flamingos, Ray Charles, you know, all this great R&B music. And so by the time I was 12 or 13, there was songs like The Locomotion with Little Eva and the whole Motown thing was kind of starting almost at the same time that the Beatles thing was happening in a way. I was not a big Beatles fan. I liked some of this stuff. It was, you know, maybe some of the earlier stuff I kind of liked it. I've always liked all kinds of music, although I gravitated more towards R&B or anything that was rhythmic. So even if it was a pop record that was rhythmic enough, that sounded R&B enough or fit that kind of feel, I would gravitate towards it.
Okay. So you're in college. How do you end up getting in the music business?
Okay. So I started working at a record store. And on Mondays and Thursdays, we would place the order. Well, first of all, like I was a avid record collector. I mean, and I spent every dime I had, you know, buying records. And then I was, you know, back then you could look on there and you could see who wrote it, who produced it. There was usually an address on the bottom, whether it said Detroit, Michigan for the Motown, or Atlantic Records, New York, New York, or whatever. For the most part, it you know, the label would have, you know, where they were from. I don't know if all the music was produced there. I mean, then you knew that, you know, some stuff was recorded in Muscle Shoals or Memphis or whatever. But for the most part, every label had an address on the bottom of it. So working in the record store, so like on Mondays and Thursdays, we had to place these orders. And we'd have to go to the distributor on Tuesday and Friday and pick the order up, the local distributor. One of the local distributors was a distributor called Tone Distributors, and they were the largest independent record distributor in the southeast of the United States. They distributed independent distributor for Warner Brothers, for Atlantic, for MGM, for Motown, for Stax. Everybody, but at one point they even had Columbia Records and Epic, but so they had everybody but Columbia and Epic, RCA, and A&M came along. A&M, but they had everybody else. They had Dunhill, they had all these major labels. Anyway, they distributed all of them. So going back to me always paying attention to what's on the records, there was a record that came out in 1972, I think. Was I already there then? Anyway, I noticed that there was a label, like a lot of different records were coming out, because we'd always get sent the newest R&B records and, you know, whatever's going on the chart. And I noticed this address, 495 Southeast 10th Court, and that's where I used to pick up the records, at 495 Southeast 10th Court, which is Tone Distributors. And I eventually learned that an artist who I kind of grew up listening to, and he was also the host of a TV show called Where the Action Is, named Steve Alamo, was there, and everything. And that they had a recording studio in the back, and that's where these records, it said 495 Southeast 10th Court, were being recorded. So I remember once I learned that, I learned some other things, that there's a writer named Clarence Reed there or whatever. And I wanted to have a meeting with him. And I eventually quit my job at the record store and asked Henry if Henry was the owner of the Tone Distributors. I got to know him because he would always be in the warehouse, you know, when I'd pick up records. And asked him if he had a job there. He said he didn't. So I got a job at his competitor. And every day after work, I would go hang out at Tone Distributors in the back or whatever, and waiting for this guy, Clarence Reed. I guess the joke was always on me, because I guess he'd always told a lot of people he'd meet him and never show up. Meanwhile, while I'm sitting there, I just started doing odds and end things. You know, if the trash would be overflowing and nobody would be emptying it, I started emptying it. The phone would ring back there. There was no one answering the phone, so I'd start answering the phone. Eventually, Warner Brothers and Atlantic were going to have all their records. They were going to start their own distribution company and pull all their records out of all the independent mom and pop places. And so I started boxing up all those records and have the number and label every one of them to ship back to Atlantic Records, to Warner Brothers. And so just from all that, just hanging out at the studio, whatever, and sometimes doing a background session, eventually doing some co-writing and playing on some stuff and just kind of hanging out there, you know, until, you know, the place we closed, and finally Henry gave me a key to the door. So I could kind of come and go and, you know, just slowly learning everything I could there. Promotion, you know, eventually starting my own oldie section in his warehouse, you know, because there's all these boxes and boxes of old records up in the attic and stuff, which I was like in heaven, because he said I could have anything I wanted. It's like, holy cow, I just died and went to heaven, you know? And so, you know, just hanging out and, you know, being in the right place, not stepping on anybody's toes or anything, and just finding my own way and creating the little management company thing or whatever, and just helping out, you know, just to be a part of it. I wasn't there to take over anybody's position in particular, whatever. I was just there to be anything and everything anybody needed, you know, at any one time. So eventually, you know, I worked my way into the studio.
Okay, a couple of questions. At what point did you stop working for the competitor and start working for Tone?
I don't remember when that was.
Not really important. Do you still have all those records you collected back in the 60s and 70s?
Yes, every one of them.
How many records have you got?
Oh, I probably have over 15 or 20,000 records, 45s and albums.
And do you play them?
No, they're all in storage in
Okay.
my warehouse.
I have all mine, same deal. Okay, so
I did have them all here and they were just sitting there and I just said, let me just box them all up and
to what degree do you learn the studio itself, becoming an engineer, etc.?
wow. Well, during the whole process, I mean, so there were other artists there and other people that nobody was paying attention to. So, those nights or whatever, I would go in and, get some of the people that were studio musicians there to come in and, I'd mess around and play, mess around on the board and do my own recordings because, it wouldn't look like ever anybody was going to like, hey, here, you do it. So again, just trying to learn everything. I eventually, got up to the board and had somebody show me enough to, where I kind of knew what I was doing or what my ears were hearing and that sort of thing. And that's so just kind of writing these little songs for these other artists that everybody was paying no attention to.
Okay, were you writing him at home or writing him in the studio?
Well, it happened in different places. A lot of times, I'd come up with the idea at home or whatever, and then go to the studio. I mean, it wasn't like I had to record it or anything because once I get something in my head, it stays in there quite a while. And I always felt like if it doesn't, then it wasn't meant to be. So, whatever stayed in my head, that's what I would work go in and work on the next, whatever, or, prepare myself. Again, sometimes, I would do it right there in the studio, but
Okay, what point does your independent workings at night cross over into the mainstream of the studio where you're now working to make records they're interested in?
well, I mean, I was always trying to make a record that they would be interested in. So, I had three or four records. So it wasn't, I was managing Timmy Thomas at the time, who had a big hit called Why Can't We Live Together. I booked him at a show in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol Center with Rare Earth. Prior to that show, I had gone to a wedding, I believe it was Betty Wright's house or something, and she had hired a what's called a junkanoo band to play at the wedding. And junkanoo music's from the Caribbean. I've mostly associated with the Bahamas. It's drums, horns, and whistles. And it's very infectious. You can't help but move when you're anywhere near it. So anyway, I booked Timmy on this show in Washington, D.C., and the entire audience was blowing whistles. And I thought, wow. And I thought, it'd be great to take this music that I just was at this party and bring it to the masses and do these whistles. So I wrote this song called Blow Your Whistle. I went in the studio and got some of the local guys there, and I recorded this record. I brought in the Junkanoo band and had them play on the record, and I wrote this song called "Blow Your Whistle," and now I needed to come up with a name, for who I was going to be, and I didn't want to use my real name or any part of my real name, so I came up and I called it Casey and the Sunshine Junkanoo Band.
Okay. And then continue the narrative. What happens with your career?
Well, so Henry puts the record out in the normal fashion. He presses up a few hundred, whatever, puts it on some local radio stations and a couple other stations, and it starts making a lot of noise. And then spreads a little bit into Europe. It goes to number 18 on the R&B Billboard R&B chart, and enough to where making enough noise to where now Henry wants another record. And so now I think, well, I loved horns and everything. So now I write this song called Sound Your Funky Horn. And it's just basically a song about, everybody, sound, bass member in the bottom, which is the bass, bass member in the bottom, drummer drum the beat, which is the drummer, tenor man, which is a like saxophone come blow your horn. Everybody get on your feet. Everybody sound your funky horn. So now sound your funky horn starts doing the same amount of noise, even a little bit more than blow your whistle, but still goes to number 18, I think, on the R&B chart. It might have gone a few points higher. I can't remember. I'd have to look. And so now I'm in the studio, and we dropped the Junkanoo Band. I dropped the Junkanoo Band name, and it just becomes Casey and the Sunshine Band on the second record. So now I'm Timmy Thomas's organ's upstairs in the studio, and that he wrote "Why Can't We Live Together" on it, and it was a Lowry organ, and it had like a, you know, that time they'd started adding the beat boxes. So I sat down at the organ. I'm still writing songs for, you know, my new album and everything, because now Henry wants an album, and I'd already written some tracks, and I come up with this. I push the samba or whatever it was on the thing, and I start playing these chords or whatever, and and Rock Your Baby was born. And so I was looking for somebody to, I didn't think it was like something that, it was a little different than I was writing, you know, for that I'd done for Blow Your Whistle and Sonya Fuck You On, and what the direction I was already writing for other stuff on my, on the Casey and the Sunshine record that I was working on. And so at the time, I thought about Jimmy Bullhorn singing the record, and I was waiting for him to come in, and George McRae showed up that day. And I said, "George, come over here and hum this melody." And I hummed the melody to him. And the minute I heard his voice, I knew that he was the one that should sing this song. And I took him in, went up in the studio, and we recorded the song. And 4 or 5 weeks later, it was number one in 51 countries around the world.
Okay, a couple of things. It's considered to be, it's 1974, the first disco record, dance record, is considered to be the Hughes Corporation, Rock the Boat, and then George McRae's song. Which came first, the sound or the nightclub? Were you making this totally independently, or were you aware of a nightlife scene that you were trying to make music for, that you were participating in?
Okay, well, I was aware of a nightlife scene, definitely. But it wasn't any different than the Sock Hops. So all they were doing is playing records, you know. But the part behind Casey and Sunshine Band sound and that whole creation was I loved dance music. My mother loved dancing. I've always loved anything up-tempo. And I would get kind of, you know, disappointed when there'd be this great dance record come out and then you buy the album and it was all these slow songs and all this other crap on there. So I wanted to change that. I wanted to make every song up tempo and on side A to side B. So that's what I was doing with Casey and the Sunshine Band. Besides that, I believe we might have been the first ones to ever do a 12-inch or a longer version of a song, you know, strictly for the clubs with Rock Your Baby. We took the instrumental, the record, took the vocal off, spliced in about 3 minutes of instrumental, and then added the vocal back at the end, making the song 6 minutes and 10 seconds long or something like that.
So Rock Your Baby goes to number one. What's next for you?
Okay, so now, they make a deal with the label in the UK, and the owner of that label, Sal Kasner, I think, David Kasner, comes over and wants to hear the new Casey and the Sunshine Band album. So one of the songs I'm playing him the album, and here's this song on the album called "The Queen of Clubs." And he says, "That's a number one record in my country." I'm thinking, okay, that's nice. I'll take that. He takes it back to the UK, and the record shoots to number four. and not only in the UK, but kind of all over Europe, some places number one. So it's like, holy cow, you know, now I got to go on tour. I've never really played. I've never really played live before like that, you know, singing and playing at the same time. So they book us a tour over there for 48 shows in 24 cities.
Whew.
And two nights before, I have an emergency appendectomy operation. Appendicitis, you know, appendectomy. So that gets canceled. And 30 days later, we go over and I do these 48 cities in 24 days, wearing a thing around me to, you know, like an elastic band or whatever, to make sure I didn't hurt myself or anything. And now they, you know, they want the next record or whatever. And that's the way I like it. And Get Down Tonight, we're recreated out of that. And I actually changed, you know, the sound of, you know, the way I sang the songs a little bit. And actually remember recording them with a little bit of a British accent.
So how do we get to Get Down Tonight?
We get to Get Down Tonight because I'm in the studio, really. A lot of times when I would work on a song, sometimes I have a title, sometimes I don't. I had a title for that, which at that time, when I first wrote it in the studio and came up, you know, did the chords and the melody, everything, it was called What You Want Is What You'll Get. And, you know, it was kind of a working title or whatever. And the more I thought about it, you know, it just wasn't ringing the bells for me. And Get Down was kind of a saying at the time or whatever. And, you know, I started thinking, get down, get down, get down tonight, you know, and then wrote about, you know, what are the things I like to do? What are the things you like to do? You know, do a little dance, make a little love, get down tonight. And then creating the story kind of around that, you know, with being with somebody else. Baby, baby, let's get together. Honey, honey, me and you. Do the things we like to do. Do a little dance, make a little love, get down tonight.
Yeah.
Was that simple?
Okay, wait a second. I was more of an FM guy, but is living out west at the time, and you drive on these long stretches prior to satellite radio, you'd be flipping the dial. You hear stuff on AM radio, which had a large area of coverage. You heard that track once, and no matter what kind of music you liked, you immediately got it. You said, holy shit. Okay.
Right. I remember the first time that it's very interesting because we'd always recorded everything at TK, but because we needed to add more things to it, we went to Criteria to do the vocal and the horns and the backgrounds. The night I finished that vocal or whatever, and I must have played that song 100 times because it was just so infectious. I knew there was something special about it. As a matter of fact, when Henry finally put it out, it went on the Billboard chart at 95, and the next week it fell off the chart. And I went to Henry, I said, Henry, this is a hit song. What's going on? He says, don't worry about it. That was it.
Well, that's what people who don't play at the elite level don't understand. When you do something that good, you know it. Okay.
Yeah.
And you rarely can get it. You can't hit that every day, every month. But when you get there, you certainly know it.
Right.
So, okay. Now you're off and running. Okay. With the next track is That's the Way I Like It.
Yeah.
So, you know, now you have a success. Now you got to worry about following it up.
Well, the two songs were almost recorded within the same period of time. You have to understand now I've moved from the first album and now working on the second album. So tracks were in progress, whether it was, you know, and all the songs were almost recorded a year before. So Get Down Tonight, That's the Way I Like It would have been recorded in 1974, late 74, whatever, after I got back from touring England. So
it was already in the can before the Get Down Tonight.
It was already in the can.
And then what about Shake Your Booty?
What about it?
How'd you come up with that?
Booty. Well, It's an interesting story behind that. Other than booty being a famous, another word that was popular at the time. But, you know, from doing these concerts a lot of times, I'd be in situations and, you know, there would be, I just felt like still people were a little afraid to let themselves go, to let themselves be what they, whatever they want to be, and still had this fear of like, is it all right to get up? And so I'd be doing these concerts and, you know, thousands of people be standing up and I'd be drawn to the one person sitting there with their arms crossed or whatever, which sometimes that's kind of me. But it's not that I'm not having a good time. It's just, I'm comfortable and relaxed. But anyway, so it was kind of a song about, and also I felt like a lot of people didn't have enough faith in themselves and believe in themselves enough. And it was kind of a song meant to be, let you know that you're as good as the next person or as anybody else. Get up and shake your ass. Get up and shake your booty. You know what I mean? You're the best. Let's see. You can do it very well. You're the best in the world. I can tell. You know what I mean? Shake, 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 shake your booty. So it was that kind of thing, like a little bit of a motivational thing in a way for people to have a love belief in themselves and to enjoy life, to shake your booty.
And now you're on a run. Do you feel the pressure to have more hits, write more hits?
No, I mean, first of all, you have to understand I came from a label that had nothing but one-hit wonders. I out of all the songs, I wasn't sure about Shake Your Booty until, because it just seemed too easy to do. The vocal, everything was just so easy with that song. And I remember it wasn't until we performed it the first time, I think right before the record came out in Dallas, Texas, at Six Flags Over Texas, Arlington, Texas, or wherever Six Flags is there. And, you know, the fans went nuts. I mean, they went nuts. And it just felt right even performing it. It just felt like, wow, I was, you know, this is going to be huge. And, you know, and it was.
Okay.
Number three.
You're working at an independent label, which is still independent after the Wild West of what comes before the 60s and 50s. Okay. Yep. So ultimately when the label went bankrupt, it was sold to Morris Levy's Roulette, which needless to say has a reputation of working in the mafia world. You're working at TK. To what degree are you getting an honest accounting? To what degree is the business legitimate? To what degree are you getting paid?
One to me, two or three out the door.
And you were aware of that?
Pretty much.
And you thought what?
I didn't think too much of it. I mean, I was, wasn't until I had him audited that I thought about it too much at all. That was near the end.
And how about ownership? Was there ever an issue of them wanting part of the publishing?
Well, no, I mean, so after That's What I Like It, I went and renegotiated. You know, my deal with him for half the publishing and better points and better everything.
So at this late date, what do you own?
And Henry gave me my own label. You know, I mean, he was pretty much, you know, supporting my label and everything else.
Okay. But right now, 2021,
right,
what do you own? You
half
own
of
the
my
songs?
Publishing.
Do you own the
half
walls?
Of them.
Half you half have of, half the publishing, and then how much of the writer's share?
My percentage.
Okay. So a lot of these songs were co-written with someone else.
Yeah.
And what did you do, and what did that other person do, and why did that end?
I did it all.
So why did he get credit?
We just had it was just a business thing that I gave him credit.
Okay, so he really, did he do anything for his credit, business-wise or anything?
No, he played bass and he was a great engineer. And he was good at some of the production.
Okay, so
the production.
Going back to the songs, okay? So you have maintained your ownership, you're getting royalties now.
Yeah.
And who administers those songs?
Sony.
Sony.
It's been through so many different people.
But you have continued to get paid, or do you have to audit for your money, and who knows whether you're getting paid how many cents on the dollar?
No, you know, I mean, you always do audits.
Well, but if you never worked again, you got plenty of money coming in with the royalties?
I'm okay.
You're okay. Yeah. You go on the road. What's the incentive to go on the road?
Because I have fun and I like it.
Okay, but it's not primarily money, or is it?
No.
No. So you go on the road. In the last 50 years, have there been times you've stayed off the road, gone back on, or have you consistently worked that whole time?
For 10 years, between 84 and 95, 93, around there somewhere, I didn't tour at all. I didn't want to have anything to do with this business. I hated it. I was done. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. It wasn't until Arsenio Hall wanted to see a reunion on his TV show that I realized I had stopped doing something I loved to do and started putting my feet back in, you know, out there in the water and testing the waters and put a band back together.
What'd you do for those?
So I've been doing it ever since then.
What'd you do for those 10 years you took off?
A lot of drugs and a lot of partying, just a lot of nothing.
So you weren't making music?
Kind of just living life. No, I was done. I was not going to, no, nothing.
Were you done just because the whole effect, or you felt ripped off or too much pressure?
I was just tired of it. I was kind of just tired of being told what to do, when to do it, how to feel, when to be this place and that. I just wanted to, like, I wanted life back. I wanted, like, a normal life back. That's just what I wanted. I just wanted to feel normal again, I think, just if that was even possible, which it's not because of who I am or what I've done, but as normal can be for me.
After you're done with TK, you move on to what is then CBS Records, now Sony. Good or bad experience? How different?
I left TK because I had them audited and they owed me $9 million.
Did you get it?
Nope. I said take it because I figured I would have gone to court, and when I would have been in court for years and years. And I said take it and shove it. And I signed with CBS. With Epic.
And so you signed. How was your experience at Epic?
Not a great one. Not a great one at all. I think at the time Epic was just so into the Michael Jackson thing or whatever that maybe they were just buying up competition. I don't know what they were doing, but they didn't have any. If you look at that period, they didn't have any time for anybody but Michael, because Frank DeLeo, who was running Epic, you know, wanted to be Michael's manager. Right. And I remember the first album I did for them, they were happy with it and all that sort of stuff, and then nothing happened to it. I remember going in there and say, look, I don't need your charity. If you don't like something, you better tell me. You know, if you're not going to back this and you're not going to believe in what I'm doing, then I don't want to do it. You know what I mean? I'm not a charity here. So, you know, I went and did the second album, and they got more involved in it and everything, and except when it came time to put out Give It Up in America, after it was number one for 6 weeks in Europe, they didn't want to do it. So I said, let me have the record. I went off the contract, and they paid me $100,000, gave me the record, and I put it out myself.
Okay, so you said...
And it was a number one record, even though Billboard didn't reflect it correctly.
Explain that a little bit more.
Okay, so the Billboard charts mainly are based on points they give radio stations and how far you go up the chart or when you're on a radio station. So depending on how many radio stations you're on at the time, you get points, it goes up. When stations are off of it, you lose the points. So there were a lot of stations, like in Miami and other stations, that went on it very, very, very early and off the success of the UK. And Epic didn't want to release it as a single. And so I lost the momentum and the points, even though that record was number one on every radio station in the United States of America for at least 5 to 6 weeks. There was not one station in America that record wasn't number one on. But because of the way the point system is, And the timing of the ones that went on it early and the ones that went on it late is it was coming up. Other stations were had already had it, their 6 week, you know, their period of interest starting to go down. So I was losing points here by gaining all these points, you know, here.
Okay, one other track I want to talk about. It's my favorite other than Get Down Tonight. And it's very different from the upbeat tracks. That's Please Don't Go. How did that come about?
I was sitting at the piano waiting for the next session to start or whatever, as I always did, while they were trying to get the sound of, you know, the instruments and everything else. It was always a long process. And I was sitting down at the grand piano, and just these chords just came to my head. And it was just different. I just, you know, it was just, I don't know if I was thinking like, you know, the disco thing was happening or, you know, and I just felt like I wanted to change. I wanted to do something a little bit different that I always swore I would never really do it, which was like a ballad or something slow. And, you know, it just all just, again, these things, I can't explain these things to you. I can try to explain it or make an excuse or a reason. There's no reason. There's no, I don't know how to explain how God or whatever this that is comes into my hands, sits them down on this keyboard, and all of a sudden these things start happening. Kind of beyond my control, as if it's automatic. It's just like I put my hands down and all of a sudden this starts happening and develops into this other thing that just becomes massive. I can't explain that. I never will be able to.
Did you expect it to be commercially successful?
Once I heard it, once it was done, absolutely. Oh, I knew it right away.
Any of your tracks that you thought were hits that didn't go?
I've had a few, maybe in later years, but then if I look back at, I mean, if I look back at some of them and dissect them, I could probably understand why maybe they didn't. But again, I it's all in sometimes promotion and marketing too. It's like, you know, another one reason I was leaving TK is because I felt like they were getting all these new people coming in there and they all wanted to make their mark. So they weren't interested in somebody who was already making, had already made a mark. There was nothing for them to do. You know what I mean? They wanted to make the next one. I felt like, so like here I made this company and this company was now starting to ignore me.
I hear you. So, do you think you were victimized by the disco backlash?
Not at all. Well, I mean, I don't know, because it's very confusing, because even though I'm considered and am probably one of the beginning of that whole thing, it was really R&B music that was being played at the time up until the Saturday Night Fever album or 1978 when a lot of the things changed. And so for me, I feel like I'd already moved on with Please Don't Go. Then I had Yes, I'm Ready with Terry DeSario, you know. So I felt like I'd already moved beyond that sort of scenario, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
I didn't like the word disco to begin with.
Were you a guy who went to the clubs?
Yeah, I went to club. And I went to clubs because I loved to dance. Everybody was going. So, I mean, but I, you know, I love music. So anywhere there was music, I was going to be.
And so other than when you're creating, to what degree are you listening to music today?
I go on iTunes every day and check out whatever the latest thing is or the whatever record's on. I mean, I'm really in love with this song called Imagine by Ben Platt right now. I think it's just a great song. But I don't see it making very much noise, which I don't understand why, unless it's just, they just haven't got behind it yet. Hopefully, because I think it's a great, great song, and he sounds amazing on it. But I listen to everything. I have country on my phone. I have pop. I have I have everything, you know. Music's changed a lot. I mean, R&B is not what R&B used to be. I wish it was. It'd be great to hear some great R&B music, but I don't know when that's going to happen. I see it slowly happening. There's a lot of up and coming R&B artists who seem to be embracing that historical sound, and I hear it coming out of their productions and their music, and it's kind of exciting in a way.
Okay, I saw you and the band perform on a cold winter night in 2015 in Vail, Colorado, and it was spectacular. That's what really resonated with it. Please Don't Go for me. But on stage, you make fun of yourself. Where did that come from?
That came from wanting to make myself relax and feel comfortable on the stage or whatever. It's just, especially at times when I put on a few pounds or whatever, or I'm old, you know, and some of it started with seeing young kids in the audience and thinking, you know, you have no clue who I am or what, you know. And I was trying to kind of relate to them a little bit. So, you know, one of the running jokes came, I'm your mother's Justin Timberlake. You know what I mean? So, you know, part of it came from that, but part of it's just facing the realities. Like if I put on a little weight and, you know, like, so he's like, oh, God, he's gained weight or he's done this. You know, let's just joke about it so I don't have to sit there and think about what they're saying. You know what I mean? And it just kind of relaxes me. I kind of have fun doing it. You know, does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. You tell a joke about Casey and KFC that's pretty funny.
Oh yeah, well, see, I brought in some writers and stuff to give me some lines, and that was, you know, that was one of the, you know, even though I don't really eat Kentucky Fried Chicken, I don't eat a lot of fried foods at all, but this writer, that comedic writer that writes for a lot of people, wrote that one, and it's a fun joke.
So when are we going to see you back on the road?
Right now I'm planning on going, you know, back in 2022 after this mess settles down a little bit. You know, they wanted me to kind of go. I mean, I just lost my guitar player of 20 something years. So I got to find a new guitar player, number one, and those are gonna be some big shoes to fill. Number two, you know, until this pandemic's kind of done and, you know, really kind of over, I don't want to be flying around a lot, you know, with masks on and playing, you know. I mean, I've been going, you know, on a few little mini vacations and stuff, but it's not like having to fly every day, 3 days in a row, and, you know, dealing with all this craziness out there right now. So I decided to, and then, you know, just at the time I wasn't sure, you know, just, we didn't want to put anybody in situations. I didn't know how, you know, a lot of places haven't really fully opened. I just didn't want to deal with the whole mess. It's all insanity. And I just when it's over, let's get back to business or whatever. And then at one point I thought, you know, maybe I don't want to do this anymore. I don't know. But, you know, I think I want to go back. I think I miss it. I miss, you know, I've never, you know, since I went back out, I haven't stopped. And so this whole pandemic and me being so idle after all this time, and, you know, just, I don't know if I needed it. Maybe we all needed it. I don't know. To rethink and can't think of the word.
Recalibrate.
Yeah, recalibrate.
Okay, Harry, this has been wonderful. One thing about you, have to know is your tracks are forever. It's funny, very few people can say that. Most things are of a time and they die. But yours consistently, yours sustained.
Yeah.
Really incredible. Okay, thanks for taking the time once again.
Thank you.
You bet. This is Bob Lefsetz.